If you're listening to 1001 Album Club, where each episode we discuss a different album from Robert Emery's book, 1001 Albums, is here before you die. Episode we'll be talking about the Beastie Boys, Paul's Boutique. In the room I have Rob.
It's the sound of me.
And on the line I have Ben.
Onion rings!
Oh my god.
And Kyle Beach.
Hey ladies!
Paul's Boutique is the second studio album by the American hip-hop group Beastie Boys, released on July 25th, 1989 by Capitol Records. The producer was the Beastie Boys, the Dust Brothers, and Mario C. Jr. The genre is hip-hop and sampledelia. And I'm going to read from All Music Review, Stephen Thomas Erlewine. Such was the power of Licensed to Ill that everybody from fans to critics thought that not only could the Beastie Boys not top the record, but that they were destined to be a one-shot wonder. These feelings were only amped by their messy, litigious departure from Def Jam and their flight from their beloved New York to Los Angeles. Since it appeared that the Beasties had completely lost the plot, many critics, in fact, thought that Paul's Boutique was muddled mess upon its summer release 1989, but that's the nature of the record. It's so dense, it's bewildering at first, revealing its considerable charms with each play. To put it mildly, it's a considerable change from the hard rock of License to Ill, shifting to layers of samples and beats so intertwined they move beyond psychedelia, or psychedelic. It's a painting with sound. Paul's Boutique is a record that only could have been made in a specific time and place. Like the Rolling Stones in 1972, the Beastie Boys were in exile and pining for their home, so they made a love letter to downtown New York, which they could have not have done without the Dust Brothers, a Los Angeles-based production duo who helped refine what sampling could do with this record. Sadly, after Paul's Boutique, sampling on the level of what's heard here would disappear due to a series of lawsuits, most notably Gilbert O'Sullivan sued against Biz Markie, the entire enterprise too cost prohibitive and risky to perform on such a grand scale, which is a real shame because if ever a record could be used as incontrovertible proof that sampling is its own art form, it's Paul's Boutique. Never once is the presentation lazy, predictable. The Dust Brothers and Beasties weave a crazy quilt of samples, beats, loops, and tricks, which creates a hyper-surreal alternative reality, romanticized funhouse reflection of New York where all pop music and culture exist at the same strata, feeding off each other, mocking each other, evolving into a wholly unique record unlike anything that came before or after. It is very well could be that its destiny is what alienated listeners and critics at the time. There's so much information on the music and words that it can be seemingly impenetrable at first, but upon repeated spins, it opens up slowly, assuredly, revealing more every listen. Lyrically, the Beasties have never been better, not just because their jokes are razor sharp, but because they construct full body narratives and evocative portraits of characters and places. Few pop records offer this much savor. And if Paul's Boutique only made a modest impact upon its initial release, over time, its influence could be heard through the pop and rap. Yet no matter how influential it felt, it stands alone as a record of stunning vision, maturity, and accomplishment. Plus, it's a hell of a lot of fun, no matter how many times you've heard it. All right, what do we think of Paul's Boutique by the Beastie Boys?
It's a masterpiece.
Yeah.
Masterpiece. Yeah. Literal masterpiece.
Undeniable.
No hyperbole.
None whatsoever.
Yeah. I think we throw that around a lot for some of these records, but this one.
Yeah, I'm cognizant of that. I'm trying to work on it. But you get to Paul's Boutique and it's like, come on.
Yeah, this Dust Brothers production is.
Dust Brothers, yeah.
Unreal.
Yeah. Yeah, they had a deep knowledge of music and they used it to great effect. Yeah, they're originally doing like commercials. They were originally doing commercials and such things for radio stations, which is where the editing comes in. But yeah, real fucking cool. The only gear that they used on this was an Emu Emax HD, which is basically kind of like the Emulator 2. Like Emu's Emulator was the one that was used on Duckstab, cost $25,000. The Emax 2 was about $4,000, probably a little bit more with it maxed out with its 2 megabytes of storage space having to be installed into it. But yeah, it has all the feel. It's a 12-bit sampler, so just like the Akai, like S950, S900, it has that lo-fi aspect to it. And you can tell, and this is still only a couple seconds worth of sample time, like, per thing. But if you were to turn it all the way down to 10 kilohertz when sampling in, you could get about 52 seconds. So when you listen to Eggman and the Jaws sample and the Psycho sample,
Psycho,
you can tell that those are in at 10 kilohertz because they sound like dog shit.
Yeah.
They need all of the specs.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, I heard, too, they would record to one track. They would pull a sample, pull it on the one track, mm-hmm. and let that run for 5 minutes, pull the next sample, pull it on another track, and like wait for those to line up. And they were doing it all analog, right? Before yep. digital, before you could drop it in Pro Tools. So they're literally just sampling and lining all of these things up and then mixing them on the fly. It's insanity.
It's complete.
Weren't the Dust Brothers intending for it to be an instrumental release? Yes,
this was supposed to be dance floor butt shakers, and then a chance meeting with the Beastie Boys turned it into Pulse Boutique.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
And I
greater than the sum of its parts.
I would have shaken my butt to yeah, any agree. Of these things. Like, yeah. Without the Beastie
I do
there.
Shake my butt to these things.
Yeah.
Oh, no. Like, I love the Beastie Boys, but the tracks, like the samples and the production is what always brings me back to Pulse Boutique, honestly.
Dust Brothers, yeah. I mean, this...
It is such a dense quilt that they have compiled.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it doesn't surprise me that this record was just ahead of its time. Like, I mean, only like one of these songs kind of
but it couldn't have been made... at a is different
time. No, this record was considered a commercial disappointment. You know?
I know, but why was it a commercial disappointment? I think this was at the exact right time and the exact right place. It just, this is not a sophomore slump. This is a great leap forward, and everyone around them is like your Tribe Called Quest and De La Soul. Like, they're all Public doing Enemy. The, like, this is... It's all high art. This is just happens to be like, I hate to say it, the Sgt. Peppers of sampling.
No,
no, it is. It is.
I think two things held this back.
It's super apt.
No marketing. Literally no marketing.
None.
No, none.
This wasn't on MTV. Yeah. They didn't have Fight for Your Right, you know?
Exactly. And their perceived, what would you say?
Yeah, the amount of time they took off, I guess.
Yeah, time they took off, but also their
people thought image. They were like a novelty act after,
exactly people
after yeah. licensed yeah. to ill
right. I think that hurt them so much that people looked at this and thought, well, this isn't Fight for Your Right to Party. Mm-hmm. I mean, and then the word got spread that, oh, it's not good, you know. Once one knucklehead like heard it and didn't understand what they were doing, they just told everybody else, oh, it's not that good, don't worry about it. Now I have no idea why it was panned by critics, although, you know, not all critics panned it, but a lot of them did at the time.
Because when I was introduced to this record, Rob, it was Chris Jenkins, like in high school. He's like, Pulse Boutique. I was like, all right.
Yeah.
And I hadn't like really listened to it maybe in 20 years. And like, you know, looking into all the samples and reading about how it was made, it was just had a whole new appreciation for it, you know?
Yeah, it's absolutely insane. Like, so all the tracks were done at Mario C's and then taken over and like mixed at the Dust Brothers spot, right? Or whatever. What studio were they working out of? Guys. Why do words come out of my mouth?
Well, most of the recordings were done in like somebody's apartment, right?
Yeah, Mario C.
Mario C. and the record plant is where they created
in New York City. It was the opium den.
Yeah, that's just a funny name that they came up with for their apartment. But it was the record plant. Yeah, they create a Mark C's.
Okay.
They go over to
Mario C.
Excuse me. They go to the record plant in Los Angeles, which is a fabulous, you know, studio. They got a huge upfront. What would you say? What's it called when you get money up front?
Money up front.
Positive. Money up front. They got
advance.
A good advance from Capitol, which they had just signed to, leaving Def Jam, because Def Jam owed them, $2 million from License to Ill, and they didn't want to pay them unless they did another record with them, which sounds completely awful.
That's not a good deal.
Def Jam has always been on the up and up, right?
Yeah. So they went to Capitol. Capitol's like, yeah, we love you. Here's your advance. And then they just spent time in the studio after they had all these tracks from Mario C's. And they just fucked around in the studio.
Oh, yeah, they did.
And they
ping pong.
Yeah. They got so frustrated because they were just, they could not get the same sound that they had got in literally in someone's apartment.
Yep.
So they just kept working on it. And at one time they were like, well, should we just scrap this? Should we just go back to the apartment and do it? And they didn't. They were like, nope, we're just going to finish it here. But they said it didn't. A lot of the songs, a lot of the vocals, a lot of the things just didn't work out the same way.
Yeah.
That it did. There was some sort of essence, sort of magic that was lost that was doing it in this big studio.
Probably had a lot to do with them being able to distract themselves with a bunch of other shit than just concentrating on making the music. But yeah, ultimately, this took 18 months to make.
Yeah.
18. For the cost of $1 million.
So weird.
Yeah. With $250,000 of that going to getting the sampling rights.
Yeah.
I feel like since we've last seen the Beastie Boys, they've traded their frat boy beer buzzes for clouds of weed smoke.
Yeah. I mean, they broke up for a little bit. Like,
no, I mean, like the vibe for the vibe of License to Ill versus the vibe of Paul's Boutique. Like,
yeah, they put down the brass monkey.
Yeah, no, yes. you're absolutely right. What one of the things was MCA just traveling the world and eating mushrooms every day, and then coming back like a year later and be like, "Hey, this is what my new band's doing. What do you think? That's pretty good. You want to do some more Beastie Boy stuff? Okay." It's a hard thing to kick, but they had a couple of years to get out of that frat boy stuff. But I mean, they won't really do like the full turn until, Check Your Head?
Yeah.
I looked out the window, seeing this bull head, ran through the fridge and pulled out an egg, sculled over my sculpts, he had no hair. Lost that shot, he was caught out there. Saw the convertible driving by, loaded up the slingshot, let one fly. He went for his to find, he didn't have one, put him in check, correct, my egg, your egg. A symbol of life, a glass of dust.
Yeah, but bless the Dust Brothers for getting it together. I mean,
yeah,
I feel like the Beastie Boys knew a direction they wanted to go, but they needed someone there that had already, you know, had it in their hands.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, you can't, like, we're going to get lots of Dust Brothers coming up.
Yeah.
I was surprised to find out that they're the number one thing they've ever done, like as far as like smash single, was Bop.
Yep.
By Hanson.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Then they did Bex Odelay, which is what I, you know, knew them.
Yeah.
Most
of course they did. Yeah.
You don't get to Bex
Tenacious D
without this record.
No, you do not. You do not.
So just to talk a little bit about the studio, you know, it said after all the work they did they go back to Matt's apartment and said they didn't. They returned the record plant, even though they didn't like what they had already got there, booked it for weeks on end to finish the record, tracking final vocals, scratches, overdubs, mixing. And then they put an arcade's worth of games in the main room of the studio. They recorded themselves playing ping pong in stereo just so it could be panned left and right with the headphones. He says, I guess it just made us feel big time.
Yeah, they had all this money and they're like, yeah, let's rent all the pinball machines.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah, I think they tried to play like ping pong to a rhythm. Like they were trying to record it like to make it sound awesome, but realized that was impossible.
Make a ping pong beat.
Yeah.
That's what happens when you get a little high.
you get that high with all this equipment around you. Yeah.
And you have the Dust Brothers.
100%.
Man, I'm really just sitting here enjoying listening to this with my headphones.
Yeah.
This record reminds me of a very specific time in my life when I first heard it. I think it was like 19 or 20 in Bloomington, Indiana, riding around in like a 15-year-old Honda Accord with the CDR of Paul's Boutique playing in a Walkman, which was playing in the cassette adapter of the Honda Accord.
That checks.
And just for an entire summer, listening to mostly just Paul's Boutique, I just kind of discovered it. I was like I knew Beastie Boys' Greatest Hits before that, and someone in Bloomington turned me onto it. And man, it turned things upside down for me for a little bit. Like it called like Sample Dahlia. I'd never heard anything like this before, even though it was like 12 years old at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. I don't know, like that's my personal experience with this record. And I always come back to it, especially for road trips. I love driving around listening to Paul's Boutique.
Yeah, it's a good one. It's got that, what'd you say, funky vibe. It's got the funk. It's got the disco.
Very much. Mm-hmm.
I saw someone comparing it to Ticks and Nation of Millions. That record, what the
Bomb Squad
was doing, and they do hard funk, like straight ahead hard funk. And what Beastie Boys is doing is a little more laid back,
smooth,
funk and soul stuff.
Yeah.
Or I should say the Dust Brothers, maybe.
Yeah. Then there's some reggae in there, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I got to talk about looking down the barrel of a gun, though, because I mentioned that I got into Paul's Boutique in high school. But like right before that, the first track I heard was Anthrax's cover of Looking Down the Barrel of a Gun, which was on the Beavis and Butthead Experience.
Amazing.
Which I think I got either like in, I don't know, middle school or high school. Have you guys ever heard that album?
Yeah, I have.
It's a bunch of like B-sides or like just junk that studios had laying around of like songs and then skits in between.
Mm-hmm.
So Beavis and Butthead like hang out with Anthrax and they're like, "What's up, Anthrax?" And they go on to their tour bus or something. And like Scott Ian's like hanging out with Beavis and Butthead, and then they do Looking Down the Barrel of a Gun.
I bet they slay it.
It's not bad.
Yeah.
For me, I got this tape. When was it? Seventh, eighth grade. Early on.
You came to it early then.
Yeah. I had a friend. We'd always talk about music and tape trade and all that kind of stuff. And I knew, obviously, License to Ill was huge, right? Mm-hmm. So everybody, kids on up, knew License to Ill. But this one took a really long time to grow, but once I got there, I couldn't get enough.
I didn't start listening to this until I was well into my 30s.
Yeah.
But I really appreciate the craftsmanship of these tracks.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Amazing.
It's absolutely incredible what they accomplished.
105 songs sampled, 24 individual samples on the last track alone.
Mm-hmm.
So
does anyone have the number on what this album would have costed to make had they actually
it's millions.
Yeah, they just said millions.
Yeah.
Although contrary to popular belief, most of the samples for Paul's Boutique were eventually cleared.
Mm-hmm.
So they did intend, or they tried to clear everything that they could possibly do. And they spent about, was it $250,000 on rights and license for the samples.
With the exception of Eggman, which is 4 Beatles samples.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the Beatles were, like the estate was threatening to sue them. And they just said, hey, what's cooler than being sued by the Beatles?
Yeah. I believe you're thinking of Sound of Science.
I am thinking of Sounds of Science. Thank
you.
Yeah,
well, there's like 4 or 5 Beatles songs.
Yeah, it's The End, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, When I'm 64, and Back in the USSR.
I love it.
Somehow I thought Eggman would have had
I'm the
Walrus on it. Yeah. Real missed opportunity.
Eggman
there.
Is the main riff of Eggman, of course, is Superfly.
That is correct. Yeah.
Yeah. They got everything. Superfly, Apache. I mean, the Dust Brothers know their stuff.
I think my favorite sample is just the one Leslie West guitar note from Mississippi Queen, but it's undeniably Mississippi Queen.
Yeah.
like looking down the barrel of a gun, son of a gun, son of a bitch, getting paid, getting rich. That's all it is. But you're like, oh shit, that's Mississippi Queen.
What I found out was there's a sample on here that was familiar. It was Stop That Train off of that giant medley at the end, which is Scotty Draw Your Brakes from 1972. But it stuck out to me because I had Vanilla Ice's 1989 CD booked. And he had a track on there called Stop That Train that had the same goddamn sample. The same year.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Surprising literally no one.
Did you notice that, Rob?
I did notice that.
That's the same year.
I just put that together, Kyle. But you just clued me into why I was like, why do I know Stop That Train? Why do I know? And it's like, oh yeah, skidlumbindibumbumbadibin.
Oh.
what's the chugga chugga paw muted sample on Barrel of a Gun?
I don't think it's
Barrel of a Gun's original instrument.
Is that not MCA?
That's what I thought. See, I thought that, but then I guess I misunderstood you, Rob, when you said the only equipment was.
Oh, there are
two songs.
There are two tracks that have actual stuff. But yeah, this one MCA jumped on and played bass.
Okay, yeah, I always just assumed it was them playing some chugga chugga.
Yep,
just him.
Oh, it's just MCA.
Yeah.
Yeah, just this one and
Hello, because then you've got the incredible bongo band on percussion.
Yep.
Yeah.
Man, I see that they sample Time by Pink Floyd on it as well. But Kyle, do you know where the Time sample is?
It's buried. I mean, I think it might just be like
I listen
for it, Ben. Yeah,
it's the little there's sort of like bells in the background that you can kind of hear. It's hard to pick out though. Yes.
Do you know, like the intro for Time?
The tong.
No, yeah. No, yeah, it's sort of like these chimes.
I
hear what you're saying.
It's what you think is Metallica's For Whom the Bell Tolls.
Yeah. I gotcha. I hear you, buddy.
Yep.
How is this not a single?
Barrel of a Gun? Was it not a single?
It was not a single.
What is
how,
the single?
How not?
Wait, I know, it's bizarre.
Like this song,
I think it's because like the first two singles didn't do that well, so they just gave up.
I mean, this is the single.
Maybe, hey, Ladies is also
for
a single.
Maybe not for 89, though.
Yeah, they did Hey Ladies.
Was Shake Your Rump a single?
I think Shake Your Rump was the B-side to Hey Ladies.
No.
A Shadrach was the second and final single.
Man, yeah. I would have released Looking Down the Barrel of a Gun before Shadrach.
Yeah.
Especially since like it mixes it up a little bit. If this is like one of the very few songs that they actually are playing instruments.
Yeah, it's a follow-up.
You know? Yeah.
You know, but except Fight For Your Right is so stupid. Like, it's wild. I don't know. Like, it's great, but it's stupid.
I don't think if
Twisted Sister followed up, you know, Fight For Your Right with like this, you know, I don't think.
Now, they did their management and everybody was like, what's the single on this? Where's you know, and they were just like, fuck it. There's no single. Like, we don't have a single. So they kind of were anti the single for this album.
They were being obstinate.
Yeah,
I'm with you, Rob.
Yeah, I agree, Rob.
The first time I heard this album, I was immediately drawn to Barrel of a Gun.
Like, what is this? The beep, beep, do, do, do,
do, do, do. Let's see, that'd be Car Thief.
Oh, Faith No More sampled that for Midlife Crisis.
Yep. And the funny thing is, Faith No More was also using the same sampler.
It is funny.
The Emacs. I noticed that when watching the Faith No More documentary. The making of Angel Dust.
Another sample that I really like is the John Bonham Led Zeppelin Moby Dick drums.
When the levee breaks?
No, it's Moby Dick. It's bringing in
what comes from Moby Dick.
Like the boop, 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 boop,
boop, boop, boop. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, on what comes
there are
around.
So many samples.
Yeah.
Love it. I also love that Car Thief, which is one of my favorite songs on this album. It I don't know if it gets much play, but it's really, really good. They do sample Donovan, Hurdy Gurdy Man. Mm-hmm. And of course, Iona Sky is, you know.
Well, Ad Rock's down with the Ione.
Exactly. Ad Rock. lady, Iona Sky, is, you know, Donovan's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
So
I did not know that.
All comes around. Yep.
Yeah.
Probably got those sample rights pretty easy.
Yeah, yeah. Just can we call up your dad? Tell you a little story about Capitol Records and the head of A&R and some of that. Says right after we handed in the final version of Paul's Boutique, the president of Capitol Records quit around the same time. The A&R guide who brought us in and signed us quit. New faces at the label, new bands on the label. Then this happened. Capitol brought us in for marketing meeting at the launch. They had to sit down with their quote unquote street team to figure out how to get the word out on the, quote, streaks. And from this, Adam's like, yikes.
Oh, my goodness.
Yep. He says, I went to Tower Records on Sunset Boulevard a couple days after it came out, and then they didn't have any copies. Oh, before that, I should mention, they wanted them to throw a diss at MC Hammer to promote the album because disses always got promotion. And they would call MC Hammer ahead of time and let him know that it wasn't a real diss. So they said, no, we're not going to do that. That's ridiculous. They go to Tower Records on Sunset Boulevard a couple days after it came out. They didn't have any copies.
What?
So the BC
store. Their local record store?
Hold on. So they thought,
Capitol Records.
Great. This shit is flying off the shelf and we are still large. It turns out that they did sell out quick, but Capitol had only sent them like 100 or so copies. No back ordering, nothing. Seriously, Capitol is literally down the street from Tower Records.
Yeah, they could send a dude with a box of records.
Exactly. The new president of Capitol Records, they finally get a meeting with him. Mid-50s, balding on top with a teeny ponytail in back, and he's rocking a brand new crisp fake tie-dyed Grateful Dead tour shirt. So they sit down, and before they can even ask what's up, the what's and why's, he's like, look, guys, I'm a deadhead, so I know where you're at. The company is just really busy right now. We're all focusing and working really hard on the new Donny Osmond album. So next time, okay.
So this is 1989.
Yes. Yep.
Wow,
Donny Osmond is not big. No. It's after his child stardom, but before his TV show with his sister.
Yeah.
Or his talk show, you know.
So they had no support. And yeah.
Yeah. It was doomed at the jump.
Well, it rules.
Yeah. Happens to be the best. It's the best sampling album of all time.
Beastie Boys have the best beats at this point of their game.
Yeah, said by Chuck D.
Chuck D. In
secret.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It did okay, peaking 24, top R&B hip-hop album chart, certified gold.
So
that September.
Despite no backing, it's still doing well in the charts?
Yeah.
Despite no singles and no backing?
Yeah, it did okay.
I mean, it has a reputation, you know.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, but I didn't know. It had to build that reputation. I didn't know for how long was it
pre-sales.
Kind of under the radar.
Pre-sales did very well.
Okay.
People were anticipating, but when it came out, that's where it kind of hit the fan. So, yeah.
And I wish I had a pre-order of Paul's Boutique.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was like, what was 8-year-old me doing? Missing the boat, that's what.
I was listening to MC Hammer.
I would have taken an MC Hammer disc very personally in 89.
I guess a lot of the stories too are true stories just on the album. Eggman is them
running, throwing eggs at people,
running around checking eggs.
Yep. Old jokers,
scamps.
From the Mondrian Hotel at the cars going by. The line "chilling with Bob Dylan" is a true story. They said, "Yeah, we were at a Christmas party at Dolly Parton's. There were these celebs, and there was Bob Dylan in the corner, and we were like, fuck it, let's spark a joint." And so we sparked a joint with Bob Dylan.
Amazing.
That's a good story.
I like some of the takes, too. David Hedeman of Rolling Stone says, "It's littered with bullshit, tough guy bravado, but it's clever and hilarious bullshit."
It is clever and hilarious bullshit.
Yeah.
Sorry, I just want to keep listening to this.
Yeah. It's really lost. Good.
I'll give you Christgau's take if you guys want it.
Yeah,
I'm into it.
Yeah, one reason nobody knew what they'd do for an encore is that License to Ill redefined rap as music. It was avant-garde rap and pop metal, foregrounding riffs and attitude any hedonist could love while eliminating whack solos and dumbass posturing. Jam-packed, frenetic, stark, the sequel isn't as user-friendly. But give it 3 plays and a half a J's worth of concentration, and its high speed, volubility, and riffs from nowhere will amaze and delight you. It's an absolute unpretentious and unsensatious affirmation of cultural diversity, of where they came from and where they want to be. They drop names from Cezanne to Jelly Roll Morton to Satahora O. Sample the Funky 4+1 twice. Johnny Cash, Charlie Daniels, Public Enemy, The Wailers, Eka Mouse, I think. Gene Knight and Ricky Skaggs, I think. Just as tags for music, there are countless funk and metal and other artists I can't even ID when I recognize them. And they make clear that they're not about to burn out on their vaunted vices. Not Chiba, not Pussy, certainly not Fame. The Beasties are still bad. They get laid, they do drugs, they break the law, they laze around. But they know the difference between bad and evil. Cracking cocaine and women beaters and stick-up kids get theirs. One song goes out to a homeless rockabilly wino, another ends, racism is schism on the serious tip. Here's hoping other bad boys take these bad boys seriously. Ay.
3 plays and half a J. I like that. I'm going to steal that from Christgau.
That's a really good review.
Yeah.
Sometimes an album takes 3 plays and half a J to really sink in.
Yeah. Love it. No, this is awesome.
Nah, it's unreal.
Would you guys consider this their best record?
I was thinking that just now.
Not my favorite, but yeah, probably their best.
Best, not your favorite? Yeah, I understand.
What's your favorite, Rob?
I mean, I'm a little basic little Robert B. I like that El Communication a whole lot, man.
El Communication was my entry. Like, yeah, Sabotage was my entry point to Beastie Boys.
I saw them like close out Lollapalooza, like on the Ill Communication tour. Like,
I bet it
the
was
close
incredible.
Of Sabotage. It was,
yeah,
you can't.
I think
we're getting Ill Communication, right?
Yes. Okay. We'll not get Check Your Head.
No.
I think it depends on which side of the coin you want to land on. If you want to land on the hip hop sampledelia side, it's this album.
Oh, yeah. If you want
the Sly and the Family Stone, like funky riffs meets what, thrash punk?
Mm-hmm.
It's Ill Communication.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean,
what's separating them? Like 3-4 years?
Yeah, something like that. This is 89, I think. Ill Communication's 94.
Yeah.
We got Check Your Head in between.
Yeah. Yep. 89, ooh, 92, doggy. And 94. Yeah. They are on a hot streak.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's unreal.
Just one more review. David Wiseman at the LA Weekly commended the evolution from juvenile delinquents to psychedelic gurus. Praised the Dust Brothers production, layers the sample. And it says it will probably be the face of all hip hop for a long time to come. He concluded with, "This album will surely put an end to any notion that the Beastie Boys were a one shot or a producer's creation."
Yep.
So, yep.
Mm-hmm.
They did it.
It ain't a slump.
Yeah.
Sophomore outing ain't no slouch.
Sophomore stretch.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
Yeah, I like that.
All right. So we're all on the positive.
Mm-hmm.
I'll Impossible. Never get sick of listening to this album. I could just listen to it all day long. I really like it.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Listen to this more.
Give it 3 plays and half a J, y'all.
Yeah. There we go.
All right, next time we'll be talking about the Young Gods, Lou Rouge. All right, thanks.
MC, what I am and do, the A is for I don't.